Session number 22905, reel 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Dick Ridgewell in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 5th of the 2nd, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. You're talking about dysentery being one of the main afflictions, I suppose. What was the most feared?
Ulcers. If you've got an ulcer on your leg, it just rotted away. See, I've seen ulcers as well, 6 or 8 inches in diameter on a shin. Well, believe it or not, a shin is only a couple of inches wide, but because the leg would swell and the bone would just rot out. And then you'd see a sort of a little white bone again trying to reproduce around it. But they just rotted. You'd have it all curing up, come up beautifully. You get up next morning, bang, it's all gone. You're right back where you started from. It's just absolute rot. It was like stinking flesh. Smelled something awful. And they say, well, the cure was to just scoop out the muck, and then whack these lumps of hot blanket, boiling hot blanket on them. And, of course, you bare skin, bare to the bone, and you get a red hot lump of blanket on that. You get about 4 blokes holding you down until it was there, but I never got an ulcer. I got a fear of coming to mind, but through them, blokes have to lose their legs.
I would assume, sort of being a working in a tap and
hammer and tap.
Hammer and tap, that there'd be chips flying around. And this is quite a dangerous thing. If you got a small scratch, it could turn into an ulcer.
That's right. Yeah, mostly on the shins. But you didn't worry about things like that, because a Jap would like to throw a rock as big as a house brick at you if you weren't working. You could hit in the back of the head with that. And I'm not kidding. I'm telling the truth, I assure you. But you didn't try to get hurt, but it was so simple. You could slip a sharp rock all the time. But you just lived, and you battled, and you fought, and you carried on.
Cholera? Did you experience that at all?
Yeah, yes. We had a camp at K2. We had a little camp about a quarter of a mile away where we used to take them. And all they could do for them was to give them a drip of absolute thick salt water. Just salt. You couldn't describe what a body looked like. It was just white phlegm used to fall out of their mouth, their nose, their anus. And they just rot away. And matter of fact, there's a bloke here, still here, Jimmy Gilmore. He's one of my mates. He had cholera and got over it, and he's still here now. He still suffers. He still has attention for it, but he had cholera and got over it. Only one I know that did. But they went out to this camp out there, and they were isolated, so we couldn't get, so they wouldn't spread. And then when they got them out there, they used to burn them when they were finished.
How can you describe to us how the loss of mates affected the camp in general?
It was so common all the time. This Clary MacDonald, his young brother, we were together, three of us, and the young Keith died, the young lad, and we just took him and put him down the hole, and there it was. And I don't think we cried, but we put him down, and they put a couple more bodies on top of him, of course, you know, but it was just common. Death was there every day.
You mentioned that you weren't a religious person. How did you sort of look at life, given your experience of what you were going through?
Well, I feel I was in a haze all the time. You kept your head down, you did what you had to do, you protected yourself, you watched that you didn't cut yourself, you only drank boiled water, you were so busy looking after yourself, seeing you and your mate as well, you know, that eat you there, that you never had time to do anything else to look after yourself. I think I was a zombie for days and days, and you sleep and work and eat your rice. And in that K2 camp, we used to get an army mug of rice 3 times a day. Often missed it, but that was the usual thing. And a little white bait, about as big as your little finger, little white bait. They got an issue of those in the cookhouse. And when we went out with our Dixies with this rice in it, we got 3 white bait each, and we went out. And when we come back, the cook was black and blue. The Japs had belted the hell out of him, because that was 3 days' supply he'd let us all have in one day, and there was hell to play. And the poor bugger, he got the whole cookhouse got belted. And as I tell you a while ago, during the same camp, I had in mind you talk about escape. Well, there was some of the officers in this camp had ideas of escaping. So I used to pinch about a little quarter stick of gelignite every time I came home, a stick of jelly and some caps. And I'd bring them back to the camp and give them into the officers there. And they used to poke them. See, the beds, everything was made of bamboo, big bamboo, 6 inches in diameter. And they poked all this stuff up the bamboos to hide it under their beds, you see. And there it was. Well, when we left that camp, of course, that was all left there. And some months later, I had to go back with a party of us from further north, come back to that camp to get some rice, some bags of rice to take up for ourselves. And when we got there, the whole of the side of the kitchen, it looked like a bloody bomb had gone off. And what had happened was that when the new Poms moved in, they did up whatever huts they could for themselves. Any old huts and old bamboo, they burnt it. And we assume they just put these things on the fire, and of course it blew the side of the kitchen to bloody pieces. The kitchen was only an open-sided thing, you know. Just blew it to bloody pieces. And they had no idea. See, bamboo was in sections, and if you split it, you could burn it. But if you didn't split it, it would expand so that it exploded. See? And they thought that these explosives must have been the bamboo exploding, or they imagined, because they never thought about explosives being buried in it. But one of the officers with Mick Wedge, he's still here, Mick. He when he came back with us, he went over to the kitchen and talked to them about it, and he knew of it because I used to bring it and give it to him. And he came to me, laughed his head off, and said, "I'm getting out of here quick before those bombs wake up."
You would stay in one camp and then, as the line progressed, move on.
Yeah, you put in a section. We're putting this cater in a section to build this section of line, both sides of the camp. And then when that was gone, we'd go a camp further up, 2 or 3 camps up, wherever, and we'd build the line there and then keep going on. I had the record. I went back up the line 3 times. See, once they'd been up and worked and went back, there was a few maintenance went up. But I had troubles and misbehaved myself, and I got sent back a couple of times. And I did 3 different trips up. I worked right up to as far as the Burma border, at a place called the Three Pagoda Pass. And those pagodas were right on the border of Burma and Thailand. And I worked up right up to there. So I worked the whole of Burma, over Thailand. I never went to Burma. And I went back there.
How long did that take?
Once again, some of our blokes will tell you the day and the date. I wouldn't have any idea what day or date it was anywhere, because as I say, I was a zombie. I was half out of it. I had my head down and I was going to live.
So this is longer than a few days that you were in this phase. This would have been months, I
assume. Oh, months. We're up there for months, yes. Yeah, I suppose from my first going up the line until I finished it all, might be 18 months or 2 years in my lot. But a lot of the boats went back and went to Japan. Others went back to Singapore. And I came back to the line just below, at the beginning of the line there. And from there I went into a place called Neck of Nyok. And I was there when the war finished. We were building, we're digging into the side of the mountain, making caves for the Japs, and an aerodrome. We're building an aerodrome and building these holes in the wall, and that's what it was when it finished.
When the line had been finished, what was the feeling then of the chaps in relation to what had been achieved and what it had cost?
There's nothing achieved for us either. There was no achievement. It was a job that was done. As I say, we did the job. If we were getting sent back, we got sent up, and we just did. There's nothing else. There was no achievement in it. And they say, I built that bridge. A lot of blokes fell off the bridges and fell into water. And the same as pile driving, you know, your blokes got washed away. We ran pile drives all by hand and pulling a rope, and you're out in water up to your neck pulling on that side, and if something came down the river and hit you, you got washed down. Could have been a body or a log of wood, but we never lost anybody that way, but there were bodies floated by, you know. It was fast flowing all the way.
Well, we have these sort of stories of the bridge over the river Kwai with this honour and being a good worker and all of that sort of thing, and then when the bridge is blown up, this sort of...
The bridge over the river Kwai is all bullshit. A whole lot of it. I believe it was built around the bridge we built at Tamarkan, which was the only steel bridge, cement and steel bridge on the whole line. I was there when that got bombed out. I pulled out a 2,000 pound bomb. I believe it was built on that one. This one, they brought the steel bridge from Java, and we built the cement pilings, and we put the bridge across there. And I understand, but the type of bridge that they had in that picture, we built dozens of them. Dozens. I had a couple of pictures. My mate's got them. Yeah. But we went into the jungle. We cut logs anywhere from up to 2 foot in diameter, and we carried them, physically carried them. Put a piece of wood underneath them, two or four blokes each side, and then about 20 or 30 in length, and we'd just pick up the whole log and carry it over. And then that they built them. We never actually dug the bases into the ground at all. They were supported, and the amount of timber that went in was colossal, but they had angles and tied, and we had steel spikes that they drove into them, and one bridge, they called it the Pack of Cards Bridge, you must have heard about it, everybody has, but it was built there, and the whole thing fell over like a pack of cards, because it had no support. It was 3 tier high, and you know, they got elephants in, and us, ropes on them, and we pulled the bridge back up again, and made it fast, and then we filled it in. With baskets of sand, we filled the whole bridge in and made an embankment of it. But bridges are everywhere. In Burma, they all had they are all wet country. We had these gullies and bridges to build because our country's water. I believe, that's the story I heard, that I don't know if you ever remember, but Frank Buck used to write books on the wilds of Siam. He used to go shooting tigers. I remember the books when I was a boy. Well, he used to go into this jungle 25 miles from Kamburi, into an area there, and that's where he used to do all his, write all his books about in there. Well, we started at Kamburi, we went in that 25 miles right through to Burma.
Mentioning the feat of what was involved in building this railway and the cost of men. In looking back, how did you feel about it at the time?
Well, you couldn't feel. There was no feeling. You if a bloke fell off and got killed, the bill's gone. You were too busy trying not to fall off yourself.
Was there a stage when you sort of would actually sort of envy those people that had passed on?
No, not me, and not anybody I know. No, you were going to live. We were going to live. We were going to make it. We knew we'd make it. There were people gave in, very few, but not Australian.
So how did things improve on the railway after the purge?
Well, after we'd built it, there was always somebody going back up the line on maintenance, keeping it going. But otherwise, we went down to the camps down Tamarkan and Kamburi and Tarso and those places, we were just there. And we went did a few working parties in there and kept the camp going, you see. And we're all there, and from there then they worked, got parties to go to Japan. Parties to go to some of the islands somewhere to work. But it was almost rest, you know. Because when they wanted you, they had you. When they didn't want you, you're just forgotten. And because you're battling for tucker all the time.
Given the fact you were in the jungle, was it possible to, as you had mentioned earlier on about Changi, was it possible to supplement your diet with local vegetables?
Yes, so if you had some money, if you sold your watch and had some money, you could buy some vegetables from the locals through the fence. Or when we went out at night, we'd buy them and bring them back. But in Changi, they did an enormous amount of gardening. And they grew all sorts of vegetables, mostly sweet potatoes. And they had big gardens there all the time going, and that's where they got their greens. Otherwise, there was no greens at all. And up the line, we didn't get any greens up there, don't we? I can't think of anything. Oh, we used to get some bags of little onions, about as big as the top of your thumb. Onions, and of course they would peel them and put them in the tucker, and anything to flavour the rice, anything at all. But 90% was rice. Amazing what you can do with rice. And of course our cooks, when they got here, they used to make what they called duvas, a little cake or something like that.
Sorry.
Where they could, they'd make. As a duva. Now, a duva was always like a cake or a scone or a ball of rice. And then if we had some onions to flavour it, or they would burn it and give it a flavour. Or if we got some pumpkins, a flavour from pumpkin in it. You didn't waste any pumpkin skin at all, you had a lot of that. And they made all sorts of things like that. In fact, Dan in Changi, remember Jack Ewan, and he died a while ago. Old Jack, he was in the cookhouse. He'd been shot in the foot and he could hardly walk. And he had vegetables rotting and so forth. What do you call it? Did you make bread out of? You had bread to use?
Yeast.
He was making yeast. He had skins of veggies and a bit of rice and stuff, and he had this pot there. I remember one night in Changi, I went in to help him clean up after the meal at night, and he gave me a mug of this yeast. I was as drunk as a monkey with it. But, you had no idea what the fellas did to get there. So you're up in this cave too, I'm telling you about the Japs had a big fish, I don't know, 18 inches long. They just took the fillets down both sides of it, through the head and tail in the bush. And my little mate, Claudie Dow, and he died a few months ago, Claudie got it and put it into a 4-gallon head and everything. I just washed it, put it in the head into a 4-gallon drum of kerosene tin full of water and boiled it. Well, we came home that night and had fish soup. It was colossal, see? Absolutely colossal. Now, Claudie used to, he was together, Claudie, when I came out at night, he used to always have 2 4-gallon drums. When I was in, this was during the purge, he worked in the camp making axe handles and pick handles, all that out of native bush. The Japs did jobs for the Japs, and he'd have these 2 4-gallon kerosene tins full of boiling water. One was for me to have a wash and a clean and a bath up, and the other one was to drink. And we'd fill our water bottles out of it and so forth. But to sit around with boiling water in a mug to drink, it was absolutely beautiful. It wasn't just cold, it was hot. You could imagine it was anything. It could have been a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, anything else, but you drank it. They made what they called coffee there too one time. They burnt rice, just burnt and burnt and burnt it, and then they crushed it up and made it, and then put hot water with it, and all it was charcoal and water, and that was coffee. Charcoal was one of our greatest medicines, one of the greatest medicines we ever had. If you had dysentery or loose bowels, you ate charcoal. And that was all, and it worked. little Claude here, Sonny Caden, we were coming down the line one time, we pulled up at a little native village, right on the water's edge, and there's the river. And all their ducks were swimming out in the river and around and everywhere. And we were out there swimming amongst them. I'll tell you about the fish there, huh? But the Claudie went underwater and grabbed one by the legs. Pulled him there, bang. And Claudie had this and put it up his shirt, and away we went. We had a duck. But in this river, there was a lot of big fish. Any time we ever caught them was when the Japs would throw grenades in and stun them. These fish, we were all in there in the nude, bathing, and these fish had been hit and bumpy in the leg, a couple of us got caught on the end of their dick. Bang! And they thought of something, they grabbed the end of their dick and scarred it and mutilated it, but they lived all right. But they thought it was a fish or something, bang. You might think it's all bullshit, all these stories, but they're true. They're really true. It was life. We lived it. And,
once the work had been completed, did the treatment of the Japanese of you?
They just left us alone. They just left us. So we went down to these camps down below, and they just left us. If they had a job to do, for instance, when the with this big bridge, the steel bridge, British planes come over and blew the middle out of it. So immediately we were all out. We built a wooden bridge across that night, across beside it. And so the trains come up to one side of it, and we unloaded the train on our shoulders, walked across this wooden platform bridge thing, loaded the train on the other side, and the train went up north. They didn't stop a minute. Okay? So we pulled out for that. And see, there's so much to do. In this particular camp, too, there were some pigs. The Japs had pigs, and we had to look after them. But there was a senior officer of some sort coming to make an inspection of the camp. So we had to wash and polish these pigs. And we had them all shiny and clean, I think, so when this officer came. But just before he came, the dirty buggers lay down in the mud. There was other play with them. We got belted, the pigs got belted, but that was the mentality on. We had to. One Pommy bloke took a monkey with him when he up north. He had a pet monkey, he said, on each other. And when we got up the line a bit, somehow or other the Japs got upset with it, so they took the monkey and they stood that to attention outside their hut for days. And every time they kicked him or belted him or something, poor little monkey, they killed him, you know. But he bit somebody or upset somebody. And so they stood the monkey to attention. And that's true too, I'm telling you, it's true.
In relation to the bombers coming over and actually blowing up parts of the railway, how did that make you feel?
Oh, terrific. First time we ever saw a four-engine bomber. Never seen one before. They came over the first few nights, they came over high and just dropped bombs everywhere. And then the Jap, right next to our camp, just half a mile over, they put in a big ACAC position to get these bombers when they came over. So the planes came over, we could hear them coming for 5 minutes, right down low, and they just pop over the hill behind the SACAC position and be over the top of it before they were there, and then bomb the bridge and the things around. They dropped, of course, one hit and 10 missed, right? But there was a 2,000-pound bomb landed in the mud on the side. It laid there for weeks, and unexploded. Anyhow, the Japs decided we had to move it. So we tied ropes on it, and we had about 100 men. Everything was done in hundreds. You didn't get 10 men to do it. 100 men on, and of course, we had davited and ropes on it, and everybody wanted the end. Everybody was after the far end of the rope. No bugger was down near the bomb, you know. That was the humour, and of course, it was laugh and fun. And anyway, we dragged up on the side of the hill. It was still there when I left. Still there. We used to get. When we came down there, there was kapok trees. I don't know if you've ever seen a kapok tree, but a big berry, great big berry, and bursts open and it's full of white kapok. Well, when we got them, we used to be able to make ourselves pillows and things like that, you know, did all sorts of things like that. One of the most hateful buggers there were those bloody big birds, the Scavenger bloody things.
Vultures.
Vultures. And rotten big bastards, they'd sit up above you, there'd be a ten of them watching down, waiting for you to fall. Oh, they were frightening. They were frightening things.
But, as you could see the planes come over, the general feeling amongst yourselves must have been, well, things are getting closer.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh.
How did the Japanese then treat the situation?
Well, belted the Christ out of us. Because we were out there waving the cones, and then they'd, as soon as the bombs had gone over, they'd walk in with bloody big sticks and teach you to barrack for the enemy. Yeah. But we woke up to that. If you don't mind me swearing, but I'll tell you a very funny story.
Go for it.
Tommy Green, we used to, the huts were anything up to 100 yards long, with just one big platform down each side of bamboos, and you slept on them with about 18 inches a person, you know. And of a night time, it used to be freezing cold. And most of us had a rice bag, and some of us had other things. For a while, I had a Grammy Army gate coat until it. But anyhow, we were all in here, and Tommy Green and I were wrapped up to all we were wearing was a G-string, and we were wrapped up with each other like two lovers with our rice bags over us, and Glenn, we were sound asleep. Anyway, what had happened in our absence was a Jap came in and did a count, a check on who was in the hut, and there was one man short. There was hell to play. He was screaming up and down and carrying, and we didn't know anything about it. We were sound asleep, we were worn out and whatever. Anyhow, he finished up, they found us. They took him round points, and he said, two men fucking, and shot out loud. That was the end of the roll call. But that's, I say, little Tommy Green, he's dead. Little Tom. Well, that's about my life, I suppose. Well, I haven't started yet, I suppose. I came home, finished all the war, nothing more you'll know about up there, I suppose.
Well, we can talk a little bit more about it later, but I wanted to discuss with you, okay, you've got things that you would think about. What were the strongest things that you would think about other than food? In relation to your situation and what might be going on in the outside world?
Well, what was going on the inside? What was what our mates were doing? What we were making? How we were coping to assist the sick blokes? And see, if we were in a camp and there's a sick boy, well, we'd boil a bucket of water and go over and wash him or polish him or something, you know, and make sure they got things. But there was, we always. Well, you just gave up wondering when we get out. It was next Christmas. We're going to be out by Christmas, and there's always the furby. But no real thoughts of that.
So can you tell us, you went back to the initial camps that you'd come from, and tell us where you were as things obviously came to a head in relation to the war and it winding down.
Well, when we left up the line, we were all brought down to a camp at a place called Nakanai Yok. That's where I was finished, and I was laid up there. I had boils, both ears were full of boils, and there was a night time where she had a piece of rice, hot rice, and lay was on my ears, and in this camp, and then next thing the war was over, and planes come over and dropped food, dropped pass, dropped everything.
Did it come as a huge surprise to you that the war was suddenly finished? Or have you heard?
No, I hadn't heard a thing. But when we were in this camp, when the war was over, other than Tommy blokes came in from outside. They'd been outside the camp in the jungle for weeks. And I always remember that little steam engine, little tiny steam engine, about as big as a brick. And he used to feed little sticks like matches, and that was their generator for their radio. And they were in touch with the planes overhead. And then when it was free, they came into the camp. And of course, we took over then and sold the camp commander's bike, and they dropped. We went to town and played up, and we got. Food, food, food. We used to get the Japanese, not Japanese, the Malay, Siamese liquor was called Lao, and we get an army water bottle full of that, and then we'd get a 4-gallon kerosene tin, and we'd fill it full of limes, only limes, and squeeze them into it, cocoa, and anything else we could like that, and then pour this bottle of lime in it, and then we'd all get pissed.